Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A brief housekeeping note before diving into the substance of today's conversation. As many of you know, we are a free educational podcast sponsored by Baylor's ISR. We do not have a large marketing budget. In fact, it's zero. And thus, we rely upon social media as a means of communicating our presence. We encourage all of our current listeners to help us gain additional listeners by word of mouth or by using a variety of social media apps, including Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, Google+, or anything else that might be invented today. Now, we are not on all of these media outlets, but we do have a Facebook fan page and a Twitter account. So if you do use those things, please connect us there. We won't overload you with too many messages, but we will keep you informed and let you know what is coming up on the show. And on today's show, I've had many distinguished guests on my podcast over the past 4 years, including last week's interview with a Pulitzer Prize-winning recipient, Karen Elliott House. But none have matched the number of honorable decorations that today's guest has. Dr. Robert George is the McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence in the Department of Politics and the director of the James Madison Program at Princeton University. He has authored or co-authored well over a dozen books, including In Defense of Natural Law, Making Men Moral, Civil Liberties and Public Morality, The Clash of Orthodoxies, Law, Religion, and Morality in Crisis, and Conscience and Its Enemies, Confronting the Dogmas of Liberal Secularism, all of which, and more, we will link to on our website. In the category of honors and awards, Professor George has been the recipient of the Presidential Citizens Medal in the United States, the Honorific Medal for the Defense of Human Rights from Poland, the Canterbury Medal from the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, the 2005 Bradley Award for Civic and Intellectual Achievement, the Sidney Hook Memorial Award of the National Association of Scholars, and the Philip Merrill Award for Outstanding Contributions to the Liberal Arts of the American Council of Trustees and Alumni. Whew. Most recently, he served as the chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and his work there will be the main focus of our discussion today. Finally, it should be noted that he was born in Morgantown, West Virginia, plays the banjo, and hunts wild turkeys. Robbie, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
I always like to get to know my guests a little bit before we dig into the substantive details of the scholarly discussion. So my first question for you is going to be, how does some kid born in northern West Virginia end up as a full professor at Princeton with that list of honors that went on and on there in the introduction?
Well, he's one very lucky guy, I'll tell you that.
Oh, I think there's skill there.
I have the blessing of being brought up by a wonderful family. My parents were not themselves well-educated. They didn't go to college or anything like that. But they put a high premium on education. They valued education. And my mother in particular was eager to see me not only go to college, but to go to the best college I could. And she encouraged me to look at colleges out of state, which not many of my classmates were doing. So I ended up at a little intellectual hothouse, Swarthmore College, and went from there to Oxford and to Harvard, and became more and more interested in intellectual life, especially under the influence of my wonderful mentors, the professors who really guided me, Linwood Urban and James Firth at Swarthmore, John Finnis at Oxford. And then I was just very blessed to be in the right place at the right time when Princeton needed to hire a person in my field, in the field of philosophy of law and moral and political philosophy. So I've had a very happy professional career here at Princeton. I'll be entering my 30th year, Tony, this year, which is very hard for me to believe. And I've had the wonderful good fortune here to be able to teach brilliant, brave, wonderful students, some of whom you probably know or have heard of. Ted Cruz is one, for example, Ramesh Panuru of National Review, Sharif Girgis and Ryan Anderson, my co-authors on the book What is Marriage, Man and Woman of Defense. and many, many others. It's just been an incredible joy and a wonderful journey.
We've had a few of your students on our show before, too, including Micah Watson, so your influence does extend far and wide.
Micah's one of my very favorites, all 6'8" of him. What a great guy, great thinker, and just a wonderful person.
He's a political philosopher, too. He's obviously following in the role that you mentored him in. And here's my question for you. You mentioned that your parents were not well-educated. You were probably a first-generation college student. How do you end up in political philosophy, picking that course over something like engineering or medicine? I mean, usually the first generation kid, they say, oh, we want you to go into something very useful with your life, like engineering, to learn how to build bridges or become a doctor. Why political philosophy?
Well, you're right. I noticed the same thing among many of my students who are first generation college, recent immigrant families and so forth. There's strong pressure from parents to go into fields like engineering, practical fields, fields where it's pretty clear that you can get a job, a good job, good paying job, right out of college. There's strong pressure to think of college as a way of stepping up the social and economic ladder, and that's certainly not a bad thing. I mean, social mobility historically has been one of the great wonderful things about the country. Unfortunately, we don't have as much of it as we used to, and that's something we really need to work to rebuild. But I know what you're talking about. In my case, I think I can explain it this way. I was interested in politics really from a very early age, when I was even a young teenager. My mother recruited me into the pro-life movement when I was, 12 or 13 years old. She was active in the movement. That was before Roe versus Wade, just before Roe versus Wade, when some states were beginning to liberalize their abortion laws, and my mother saw this for exactly what it was, the deliberate killing of the child in the womb. So she was involved, and she got me involved. Politics was also something that was regarded in a positive light in my family, not some bad thing or evil thing or even necessary evil. Both of my immigrant grandfathers were coal miners. My father's father remained a miner and a laborer his entire life, and my mother's grandfather began in the mines, began in the mines and was able to save up enough money to get out of the mines and open a little grocery store. But they were union men. They were great followers of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They were people who believed in America and in the promise of America and in making things better for ordinary people, for working people, through politics. So I became active not only in the pro-life movement, but in the Democratic Party. In those days, it wasn't a contradiction to be both a pro-life person and a member of the Democratic Party. Unfortunately, it's become that today. But I became active. I joined the Young Democratic Organizations. Twice I was elected governor of the West Virginia Democratic Youth Conference. I attended the 1976 Democratic National Convention as an alternate delegate from West Virginia. That was the convention that nominated Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale. So that's how I ended up interested in politics. And really, in college at Swarthmore and then more at Harvard and Oxford, I became interested in the theory of politics, the basis of the normative basis of political judgments, how we ought to think about issues such as justice, the common good, human rights. And I have no doubt that reflection on the abortion question and watching the Democratic Party collapse in exactly the wrong direction, head in exactly the wrong direction on abortion, really got me thinking about the fundamental ethical bases of sound political judgments. So that's how it all happened.
There's one other interesting aspect of your career that is not very typical of most academics, is that you have a number of different degrees, including from Harvard Divinity School and from the law school, in addition to your PhD from Oxford. Do you think these different streams of thought really helped you throughout your career and thinking about the issues that you've finally formulated into your dozen or so books?
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. I mean, I think especially thinking about questions of philosophy and theology got me moving in the direction of understanding that there are deep sources of the judgments that we make, both as individuals and ought to be self-critical and self-aware, at least. We should know what the presuppositions as well as the entailments of our views are, so that we can think about things in a more credible, more rational way. And there's obviously a lot of irrationality in politics. People don't often enough pause to consider the assumptions, the premises, the presuppositions of the views that they hold. And studying philosophy and theology helped me to see that it was very important to do that, to examine one's own premises, to explore where one ought to be, not just by, you know, looking around at what other people think, but going deep into the premises of arguments and looking at what can be learned from the great figures in the history of thought. In college, I became very interested in Plato, for example. And there's an enormous amount to be learned about ethics and about politics just from reading the dialogues of Plato. And of course, I went on from there to read Aristotle and some of the great Christian thinkers such as St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, as well as then, you know, Enlightenment figures such as John Locke, the American founders, and so forth.
So that explains the theological and philosophical angle, but what about that legal degree that you have? How is that useful?
When I went to law school, I wasn't quite sure whether I wanted to be a lawyer or be an academic, or possibly be an academic lawyer. You'd be a law professor. And it helped me to sort all that out. Also, I knew I was interested in philosophy of law. And I knew in particular that I wanted to study philosophy of law at Oxford University in England, which was then, and to some extent still is, the sort of world headquarters for the study of analytic legal philosophy. But to do that, I knew I needed a first law degree. It's a presupposition of the, it's a prerequisite, I should say, of the doctoral program in philosophy of law at Oxford. So I needed a first law degree, and I was open to the possibility of maybe becoming a practicing lawyer, to actually do a little on the side even then. So I had the opportunity to go to law school at Harvard, so I took that, and it confirmed, as I was studying at Harvard Law School, it confirmed my intention to stay in the academic world rather than to go off and practice law. I had three summers with law firms, all in Boston, very fine firms, and I enjoyed that work very much, and I could easily have continued it. But studying the various legal subjects in law school did confirm with me, or in me, my intention, my desire to go on into academic life. And then at Oxford, where I went more deeply into philosophy, at Oxford, I came to understand that my real vocation was in the arts and sciences rather than in a professional vocational school of law. So when it came time to look for academic jobs, I was really focused on arts and sciences faculties in philosophy and political science rather than in law school. My first experience actually teaching in a law school was just 2 years ago, as opposed to teaching in the arts and sciences, which I do at Princeton. My chair is in jurisprudence, but the chair is located in the Department of Politics, and then I have a secondary appointment in the Department of Philosophy. But at Oxford, it became clear to me that I really do have a vocation in arts and sciences and in philosophy more than in vocational law. But I taught 2 years ago at Harvard Law School, back at my old law alma mater, and I enjoyed that very much. It was a different experience, my first experience, as I say, teaching in a vocational law faculty. And I developed some good friendships there with current faculty, also renewed some friendships with faculty members who were there when I was a student many years ago and who are still there. So I think I'm where I'm supposed to be, doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm certainly enjoying it, and again, the best thing about it is the opportunity to teach such wonderful students.
Yeah, I should notice when you mentioned some of your friends, one of the more interesting and unusual aspects of your career is that you have a deep friendship with Cornel West, who many would look at and say, well, you two are just ideologically opposed. How could you ever get along? But nonetheless, you go around the country doing speaking tours together. How did that come about?
Well, we do, and we teach together, and we truly love each other. He is a very dear brother. We're in a peculiar way, we're sort of soulmates. I know people can't make much sense of that because our concrete political views are so different. I'm a conservative, and he's, you know, pretty far out there on the left. But we're both people who are interested in ideas. We both believe in the importance of exploring the premises of our beliefs. We believe in the importance of self-criticism and intellectual humility. We're able on that basis to engage each other, not as adversaries, but as friends in the pursuit, despite our differences, of the common good of getting to the truth of things. And now the pursuit is dialectical, that is, we go back and forth, testing our arguments against each other. But nevertheless, it's a cooperative project. When Cornell and I talk to each other, whether it's on one of our speaking engagements outside of Princeton or teaching together, we've taught together at Princeton several times, and we'll be doing it again in the spring of this coming academic year. Whenever we talk with each other, we don't talk for victory. Our common goal is to get at the truth. We're open, open-minded, open to argument, open to reconsidering a view in light of the pressure of rational arguments, or under the pressure of rational argument. So that's a lot to have in common. Cornell is also, as I am, a person of faith, a believer. He is someone who shares my conviction that we're under quite a profound obligation in this life to bear witness to the truth, to take risks for the truth, to make sacrifices for the truth, as best we can understand the truth as it's given it up to us to see the truth. So there's a lot to build a common bond on, and it's a very, very, very strong bond. Don't have a dearer friend than Cornell.
He didn't promise you a role in the next Matrix movie, did he?
Oh. Yeah. No, I don't think I have the looks to be in the next Matrix movie.
Well, this is interesting, that talking about your academic career, and you are a specialist in the philosophy of natural law, a topic that I do want to come back to later. But I'm intrigued on how you take this search for the truth and this dialogue that you have with others and move it into basically government work. How do you go from becoming a philosopher of natural law to becoming the chairman of the Commission on International Religious Freedom?
Well, there's a bit of an odyssey there as well. Back in 1993, it must have been 92. Back in 1992, in the fall of 1992, I was sitting there minding my own business. I was still an assistant professor. I hadn't been given tenure yet at Princeton. I was teaching and doing my scholarly research. My book, Making Men Moral, my first book, was about to come out, when I got a phone call. And the phone call was from someone with a transition team for the Bush presidency that was about to come to an end. Clinton had defeated President Bush, and President Clinton was going to be sworn in on January 22nd. Anyway, someone from the Bush White House that was transitioning out asked me if I would be interested in serving on the United States Commission on Civil Rights, the United States Commission on Civil Rights, and I'd never given that a thought. I didn't know much about the commission, but it sounded interesting. There were two vacancies that President Bush was in a position to fill before he turned over the keys to the White House to President Clinton. So I accepted the offer and went on to the commission, and then served from January 20th, 1993, all the way through 1998. My appointment was actually made by President Bush on the morning that he left office. So President Clinton was stuck with me for his first term and a good part of his second term, when my own term on the commission finally expired. So I enjoyed that work. I was able to lead our commission's investigation into violations of religious freedom for Christians and other believers in America's public schools. And then a few years later, when we had another Bush presidency, when George W. Bush was elected president, he organized the President's Council on Bioethics to advise him on the then very new and very hot issue of embryonic stem cell research. The commission was to be chaired by Dr. Leon Cass, and President Bush invited me to join that commission as one of its 18 members, which I was delighted to do because I was so interested in the issue, and I think thought the issue was so important. And I had done work on that issue in the bioethics area. So I served on the President's Council from 2002 to 2009. So I had this experience Boehner asked me if I'd be willing to serve as one of his two appointees on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Now, obviously, religious freedom is an extremely important issue, very timely one today, not only abroad, but in our own country. But it is a timely one abroad as well, an important one. There's so much religious persecution in the world, persecution of Christians and others. So I accepted that with pleasure, and then a year later, my colleagues on the commission elected me to be the chairman of the commission. So it's important work. It's valuable work. It's work I enjoy doing, although in a way it's somber work because there is such a tremendous amount of abuse of religious freedom, persecution of religious minorities all around the world, from North Korea and China and Vietnam over to Iran and Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Nigeria, Central African Republic, Cuba, and on and on.
I tend to be a nuts and bolts guy, and I always like to figure out how these things work, and I'm guessing that many of our listeners don't even know that the United States has a Commission on International Religious Freedom. So explain what that is, where it came from, and essentially how it works.
Sure. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom was created under the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998. The purpose of that act was to elevate the priority of religious liberty concerns that are, of course, so central to our self-understanding as Americans in U.S. diplomatic and foreign policy. And the act did several things. It created, for example, an Office of Religious Freedom within the State Department. In addition, it created an ambassador for an ambassador at large for religious freedom. And then it created the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. The latter, unlike the State Department office, is an independent bipartisan commission. It's not it's not part of the State Department. It is not answerable to the Secretary of State. Rather, it makes recommendations to the Secretary of State and the President based on independent inquiry, and to Congress as well, I should add. It makes recommendations for the conduct of our foreign affairs so that the formation of policy, the execution of policy, will give religious freedom the priority that Congress wishes it to have under the statute. One of the key tools that our commission has is the right and obligation to make recommendations to the Department of State for the designation of the worst offending countries in the world as what we call, or what the statute calls, countries of particular concern, CPCs. Now, when those designations are made, as they have been in the case of eight countries, serious offenders like North Korea, China, Saudi Arabia, when those designations are made, certain consequences follow as far as our diplomatic relations with those countries and our trade relations, sanctions, for example, can be imposed. The only exception when the designation is made is in a case where the U.S. government decides to give a waiver for some particular reason to a country of particular concern so that those diplomatic and trade consequences don't follow. But that's an important tool. Countries don't, in general at least, don't want those consequences. They often argue that they've unfairly been designated as CPCs when those consequences are imposed. Those are, in my experience, always unfounded complaints. The countries that have been designated as CPCs by the State Department are all countries where the violations of religious liberty by the government are egregious, ongoing, and systematic. That's the standard of the statute, egregious, ongoing, and systematic. And in places like North Korea, Iran, Saudi Arabia, China, that's exactly what we have, very gross, ongoing, continuing violations of religious liberty. There are eight countries we are currently, in our 2014 report, recommending for designations as CPCs with all the consequences that follow, that have not yet been designated as CPCs. And at the top of that list is Pakistan, which we believe is the worst offending nation among those nations that aren't yet listed as CPCs. But there are others as well. Vietnam, for example, is a very serious offender against religious liberty that has been on the CPC list in the past, was removed from the CPC list after some reforms were made, but then has backslid and is once again one of the world's worst offenders.
Actually, there's a few more interesting questions that are out there. How many commissioners are appointed, and how do they get appointed? Are they all appointed by the president, by John Boehner? Does he have his thumb on the scales? Who appoints all these folks?
Three are appointed by the president, and the remaining six are divided up as appointees between the Senate majority and minority leaders, and the Speaker of the House and the minority leader of the House. So I'm one of the two Boehner appointees. There are two McConnell appointees. There are two Harry Reid appointees and two Nancy Pelosi appointees. And then, of course, as I say, three Obama appointees and three presidential appointees. We all serve for two-year terms. It's renewable once, so that it's possible to serve a total of 4 years. The chairmanship of the commission alternates between a Democratic appointee and a Republican appointee. The commission elects its own chairman. Members are drawn from different walks of life. Obviously, the common factor is an interest in some expertise in the area of international human rights. We have had on the commission past members of Congress, professors, people who've served in diplomatic roles, including in the State Department. We currently have a Catholic priest who's a member. We've had rabbis who were members. There have been Christian, Muslim, Jewish, and other members of the commission. It's really a spectrum of people, and the commission, at least now, is working together in a harmonious way. Of course, we have disagreements about certain things. There are some difficult cases. For example, we've had disagreements about exactly how to handle Turkey, the nation of Turkey, which has a less than ideal human rights record in the area of religious freedom, but is not as bad an offender as a state like Pakistan. So where does it belong on the list? But for the most part, we find ourselves agreeing in the designations that we recommend to the State Department, and then pressing the administration to adopt those designations.
You're a pretty busy guy. You're going around the country with Cornell West, and you're giving a number of talks and things like that. How much of your time does this actually take up? Do you have daily duties, weekly duties, monthly duties? Do you meet just maybe once a year? How much of your time is taken up by this?
Well, when I was an ordinary member of the commission, it certainly took up a bit of time each week, but was not especially onerous. Meetings twice a month. One of those typically is a telephone meeting. The other is an in-person meeting at our headquarters in Washington. Serving as chairman, though, increases the workload very dramatically. Then it's a daily thing. So as chairman, I really felt I had two full-time jobs, my professorship at Princeton and all the work that's attached to that in the areas of teaching and research and administration, because I'm the director of a program at the university, the James Madison Program on American Ideals and Institutions. And then, of course, the chairmanship of the commission. So it's a lot of work, but it's worth it. And, you know, thank God I'm blessed with good health. I've had some back trouble recently and had to have some back surgery. But beyond that, I've enjoyed good health, and so I'm able to do it. And so I want to keep at it.
So was there a lot of commuting between Washington, D.C. and Princeton, New Jersey?
Yes, but I did a lot of commuting even before I went on to the commission and became chairman. And that's because I'm involved in so many advocacy organizations with headquarters in Washington, D.C., or who have activities in Washington, D.C., and the pro-life movement and the pro-marriage movement, work with civil society groups. I find myself in Washington, D.C. a lot, and not simply on commission business.
Now, you mentioned one of the other things that the International Religious Freedom Act did was to create an office in the State Department. So there must be a civil service bureaucracy underneath all these commissions. How is it working with that State Department bureau? Is it a fairly large bureau? Are the relations fairly harmonious? Or is it their difficulties that the fact that people are switching the chairmanship and people are coming and going within the actual commission that makes it difficult to work?
Well, it's an excellent question, Tony. mean, it's a small office. It's not a large office. They are supported in part by the work that we do and that our excellent staff does. One of the things that we're blessed with at the Commission on Religious Freedom, that is the independent commission, the bipartisan commission, is an amazingly expert, professional staff, people with expertise in various countries of the world, in regions of the world, really know the situation, have great contacts for getting information, and who are really dedicated people. Now, we also benefit from work that the small staff at the State Department's own internal office has. So it goes both ways. The relations have been quite harmonious. Now, of course, we're outsiders, and our job is to be a bit of a gadfly to the administration. So, you know, sometimes when gadflies are irritants, and we can occasionally be an irritant because we're pushing the administration hard in areas where maybe they're not so eager to go or not so eager to go so quickly because they've got a lot of other foreign policy and diplomatic policy balls in the air and considerations that have to go into the mix and deciding what to do about Pakistan or Egypt or wherever it is. So there will always be some tension between any administration, Republican and Democrat, and an independent bipartisan commission like the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. But having acknowledged that candidly, I should also say that I have found the relationship to be quite harmonious. It's not a problem. There's certainly nothing approaching a war, a bureaucratic war, or anything like that. I should add that we've all been disappointed that the administration has been very slow to fill the ambassadorship at large for religious freedom, which, as I mentioned, was created under the Act. Since it became vacant many months ago, we've been waiting and waiting for that post to be filled. It's an important post. Of course, the law requires it to be filled. The International Religious Freedom Act created it, not as something to be optional, but something that really needs to be filled. So we're pressing the administration to make an appointment, and to make a good appointment, appoint someone who's really knowledgeable and dedicated to the cause of religious freedom to that ambassadorship, so that we can work with that person. Historically, we have worked very closely with the ambassador. Our commission has worked very closely with that ambassador. And right now, we've not had anybody to work with. I'll even use this occasion to, plead with the administration to please fill this slot.
One of the things that you mentioned, and this is a political appointee in many respects, but you also mentioned just a moment ago that there are a number of other foreign policy concerns that come into play here. And the State Department issues an annual report on religious freedom. It documents a number of laws or regulations that have been passed or have remained on the books, as well as instances of religious persecution in all the countries around the world. It's a great source of data for a lot of scholars who actually study this stuff. But there's always one consideration that comes up when we look at these data sources, in that we wonder how much political influence there is in configuring this report. Is there some pressure by other parts of the State Department to go over to the International Religious Committee that is writing this report and say, hey, you know, we're really trying to work out an important trade deal with this country. Could you just kind of look askance a little bit at some of that religious persecution that's going on? Or is this a fairly up and up type of process that say, hey, we're just calling it as we see it?
Well, our commission is really quite immune to pressure. My experience in serving has been that while lots of people try to influence what we do, you know, we hear from ambassadors and representatives of foreign nations who are unhappy with the way they're treated in our annual report or with the designation that we've recommended or whatever. You know, we just do not yield to that. And the same is true when we get a little pushback from people in our own government that, you know, they think we've pushed too hard or gone a little too far with regard to this nation or that. We'll certainly listen to what they say. We're not infallible. We can make mistakes. If they think we've made a mistake or pushed too hard, or there's some justification for what a country's doing that we think is actually unjustified as a violation of religious freedom, we'll listen. If we have made a mistake, we want to correct it. But we don't yield to pressure. We're really united on that. I mean, the commission, I think, across the political parties and the religious groups that are represented, united in jealously guarding our independence and refusing to be unduly influenced by pressure from the outside, whether it's from people within our own government or diplomats representing foreign governments.
Now, you've been on this commission 2 years as chair, and then I think an additional 2 years before that, and now, so you're looking at about 4.5 years, that's correct?
Well, no, not quite. I've just finished my second year.
Oh.
So I was on the commission for a year, then a year as chair.
Okay.
A chairman, and I was reappointed now for 2 more years by Speaker Boehner, so I'm at almost exactly the halfway point in my tenure on the commission.
Okay, so you've been there for 2 years. You've spent a year as the chair, so you know some of the history of this commission. I'm sure you've talked to other people on the commission as well.
Oh, yes, of course. So
give us an idea of some of the major issues that have cropped up over the past decade or so, things that seem to be recurring or possible new trends that you see on the horizon.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, obviously, radical political Islam is a huge issue. And there's a lot of religious repression around the world, including of minority Muslim groups, by radicalized extremist elements professing the Muslim faith. Your listeners won't need me to mention the many nations where that is the case. I mean, Saudi Arabia is an ally of ours, a nation that's important to us, both for economic purposes and geopolitical and military purposes. And yet, it is an serious offender against religious freedom in the name of the particular sort of extreme Islam, Wahhabism, that is practiced by the leadership of Saudi Arabia. That results in the repression not only of minority Muslims, such as the Ahmadi Muslims who are there, the Ahmadiyya, but also of Christians. There are many Christian guest workers in the Saudi kingdom. Majority of them are Filipinos. Majority of those Filipinos are Catholics. And yet, they cannot attend a church because no churches are allowed to be built, or synagogues or other non-Muslim places of worship in the entire Saudi peninsula. They have trouble even bringing Bibles into the country. They can be confiscated. Officially, they're supposed to be permitted to have private worship services in their homes, but members of our commission who visited Saudi Arabia and talked to Filipinos and others have been told that actually those religious meetings are sometimes broken up or people are threatened for having those meetings. And of course, the situation is even worse in other places that are controlled by the Taliban or other radical forces. The situation is very bad in Pakistan, so forth. Also, of course, people are have their rights violated, their right to religious freedom violated by non-religious, secular regimes that are advancing often a communist agenda. North Korea, obviously, is a case of that. China is a case of that. Vietnam is a case of that. Cuba is a less egregious case of that, but there are still real human rights, religious liberty violations in Cuba. So here, in the name of a secularist ideology, people of many different faiths are persecuted. Just think of China, where Tibetan Buddhists are persecuted, Uyghur Muslims are persecuted, Catholic and Protestant Christians are persecuted, even members of the Falun Gong, which is not even really a religion, it's kind of a spiritual movement and physical health movement, are persecuted. In many places, we're fighting actual legal principles that restrict people's religious freedom, apostasy laws and blasphemy laws in places like, again, Pakistan. Iran is a world-class religious liberty offender. It's a CPC nation on our list of worst offenders against religious freedom. And in some places, the problem is not so much in the laws or even a problem of the government directly violating people's rights. It's the government standing by and permitting thugs and mobs and terrorists to violate people's rights with impunity. You've seen this, for example, on many occasions in Egypt, where the Coptic Christian minority, 8 million people, very large minority in Egypt, the largest minority religion in Egypt, Coptic Christians have their churches attacked or their businesses attacked or are themselves actually attacked by rogue elements in the culture with the government standing by and doing nothing, not prosecuting, not deterring, not setting an example, not stepping forward to do really anything that would protect these people who want nothing other than to practice their Christian faith in peace and security. So those are the kinds of issues that we're facing across the globe. There are some new issues, and that is non-state actors, such as Al-Qaeda, non-state actors in parts of the Middle East and in Africa that are violators of religious freedom. What do we do in those cases? There are some countries that no longer have effective functioning governments and where terrorist groups operate with impunity, often murdering, torturing, terrorizing religious minority communities. You see this, for example, in Somalia and in the Central African Republic. So there are lots of problems. The Pew Foundation published recently a study that we've relied on showing that about three-quarters of the people in the world, believe it or not, three-quarters of the people in the world, they put the figure at 76%, live under regimes that either themselves are significant regular violators of basic religious freedom rights or who stand by and permit those rights to be violated by thugs and mobs with impunity. It's a very sobering situation, Tony.
You mentioned the Christian Coptics in Egypt and also the Filipino Catholics in Saudi Arabia. But even before that, you mentioned, I think, something that is very important to note, and that is religious liberty not only affects Christians, but it also affects religious minorities in within the Islamic community, within other religious communities as well. And I think that's a point that we need to emphasize a bit here, because one could make the argument, well, this is the United States imposing its Christian will upon everybody else. But do you do a lot of work for these religious minorities within Islam, within other faiths, and do a lot of them appreciate it?
Oh, we certainly do. Absolutely. Now, no one should ever hesitate to criticize the persecution of Christians because it's going on all over the globe. And there's a certain narrative that's got to be defeated, that according to which Christians are persecutors, but never the persecuted. It's an utterly false narrative. Christians are far more often today the persecuted than they are the persecutors. So first, let's get that onto the table. But secondly, obviously, there are many other groups that are persecuted, and we at the Commission on Religious Freedom have been strong advocates of those groups. For example, I mentioned the Ahmadi Muslims who are persecuted in Pakistan, persecuted in Saudi Arabia and other countries. I would add the Baha'is, the people of the Baha'i faith in places like Iran and Iraq and in Egypt are brutally persecuted for their religious beliefs. And Muslims are not always the persecutors, by the way. Sometimes Muslims, frequently Muslims, the Ahmadis are an example that I've already cited, are victims of persecution, sometimes by other Muslims, but sometimes by others. For example, in Burma, Myanmar, the minority Muslim population there is viciously abused. They're called the Rohingya Muslims, viciously abused by the Buddhist majority. That's something that most Americans know very little about. Frankly, I knew nothing about it until I went on to the commission and was shocked and appalled to learn about how badly treated the Rohingya are by the Buddhist majority in Burma. Honestly, they're treated worse than the untouchables have historically been treated in India. So there are many different victims representing many different faiths around the world when it comes to religious persecution. And we at the Commission are advocates for all of them, and we think that all Americans should be praying and standing up for and speaking out on behalf of victims irrespective of their faith. Religious freedom is a universal human right. It's not just the property of Christians, it's not just the property of Jews, it's not just the property of Muslims, it belongs to everybody. And so everyone's rights have to be respected. I should add that you asked me about new worries. I'll give you a new worry that was a very old worry, and that is the rise of anti-Semitism. Obviously, anti-Semitism has a long and ugly history. One would have thought that it would have been pretty much driven out, at least in the developed world, in places like Europe. But now we see a revival of anti-Semitism in Europe. It's very worrying. And not only among immigrant populations, but among native populations as well. And we find the violations of the rights of devout Jews coming not only from, you know, skinhead and neo-Nazi, neo-fascist sources, but even from liberal secular elements who, for example, are willing to enact laws banning kosher slaughter, or even banning the practice of male infant circumcision, which is absolutely essential to the covenant on which the Jewish faith is based. You have now Northern European liberal democratic countries doing things like banning male infant circumcision, making it impossible for devout and faithful Jews who must practice circumcision with their male infant children, making it impossible for them to live there. This is extremely worrying, and we have been very vocal on our commission, speaking out against any repression of the rights of Jews, and certainly against anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I like the emphasis that you have, because even though Christians tend to be the most persecuted religious group around the globe, and that is very clear in the Pew Forum report that we will link to, but it's a human right issue that's just global, that it's absolutely universal. And in promoting the rights of Christians, we also have to acknowledge that we promote the rights of every religious believer around the globe, even though we might sometimes disagree with them theologically. I think that's a great point. Now, this brings up an issue I want to touch on in terms of your own academic experience, and that is the issue of natural law. It's one thing to expound upon the theory of natural law as an ivory tower academic who doesn't necessarily bear any of the consequences of theorizing, but it's quite another thing to be put into an advisory role where your decisions and your actions do have consequences and very important policy consequences. As such, I would like to know how you deal with these two worlds, the philosophical ivory tower world and your policy advisory world. How do these things fit together, and how does your thought on natural law actually play into this? And actually, if you could, for our listeners, give a brief summary of what natural law is and how it might play into your policy work here.
Okay, sure, Tony. Theories of natural law can be traced back all the way to the great ancient Greek and Roman thinkers, especially on the Greek side, Plato and Aristotle. Among Roman thinkers and jurists, one thinks, for example, of Cicero. So it is not some distinctively Christian idea, although the idea got taken up into Christianity, and some of the greatest natural law thinkers have been Christian thinkers, such as in the Middle Ages, St. Thomas Aquinas. There have also been important Jewish natural law thinkers. One of the great contemporary natural law thinkers, David Novak, Rabbi David Novak of the University of Toronto, obviously is Jewish. And there's also traditions that are in line with natural law thinking within Islam. The term natural law doesn't appear in Islamic sources much, but the idea is there under different labels. And basically the idea is this, just at the most fundamental level, natural law are the principles and norms of conduct that can be known by natural human reason, by natural human inquiry, deliberation, and judgment, even apart from any special information that's provided by way of, say, revelation. So natural law is just ethical knowledge of right and wrong that can be grasped by the inquiring intellect, even apart from any special extra source of knowledge. As I say, we find the origins of the idea in the ancient Greek and Roman thinkers. It was taken up into Christianity and other traditions. Pope John Paul II, now Saint Pope John Paul II, commented correctly that natural law, among its other virtues, gives us a common language in which to address ethical questions when we are working in circumstances of religious pluralism. So it gives us a common language we can use when, for example, it's Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Muslims, Mormons, Baha'is, thinking together about issues such as human rights, religious freedom, the rights against torture, the right to life, the common good. We can talk to each other in a common language, despite our theological differences, our differences about what counts as scripture, our differences about the proper approach to scripture, even when we agree on what counts as scripture, and so forth. Natural law theory also provides ways of thinking about issues that have not historically been addressed in the scriptures of the great traditions, simply because they weren't issues at the time. Take an issue such as cloning, creating new human beings by asexual methods. I mean, there's obviously an ethical issue that has to be addressed, but one can't find the answer, at least in any direct way, in the Bible or from a Muslim point of view in the Quran or anything like that. So that's what it is. I mean, just in sum, again, the body of norms and principles that is accessible to unaided human reason, that is natural human reason, even apart from revelation.
How does this play into your work? Because one could see that, you know, you have this U.S. Commission on International Freedom, and you're talking about natural law as being a common language and sitting down with people saying, hey, we all have this in common, 360 degrees all the way around the globe here. But and I get this from students all the time when I start talking about natural law and its application. They say, well, that's just a Western construct. You know, it's a Western construct to think that everybody thinks the way that everybody thinks that we think, and et cetera, et cetera. Is there some criticism of using natural law in the framework of the U.S. Religious Commission in regard that, well, you're not respecting other philosophies and way other people think?
Well, there shouldn't be. You know, that criticism, you know, is an uninformed and in a way quite lazy way of thinking. There was a reason that C.S. Lewis, in The Abolition of Man, the book The Abolition of Man, which is a very important and valuable book, there's a reason why he used as a synonym for the concept of natural law the Eastern notion of the Tao, T-A-O, or Tao. And that is because if you look across the great traditions, you find almost all of them looking to what reason can ascertain, even apart from any special sources of revelation. Now, that doesn't mean that they all agree on anything, on everything, but they do agree that reason has a role to play in the quest to understand right and wrong, and they should be able to agree, and for the most part do agree, that reason can provide what Pope John Paul said, that is a common language for inquiry, in circumstances of religious pluralism, into right and wrong, human rights and the common good. So I don't think that we need to be deterred or even detained by this lazy, quasi-relativistic, you know, actually rationally indefensible idea that our own ethical values are the mere product of our own Western way of thinking and have no universal validity, and that we therefore have no right to act on those principles in ways that affect people from cultures that don't share those principles. I mean, if you wanted to go through the whole thing, we're going to spend time to do it. Mm-hmm. I can show you that that's actually a self-defeating proposition. It's a self-defeating claim. Okay. If there's anything that is a kind of sectarian Western liberal notion, it's precisely that kind of relativism. I assure you, you don't find it in Islam or Buddhism.
Yeah, that is a very fascinating observation, and we could go on to hours on it, and I'm fascinated by how this would play out within the commission. But we'll hold that for another podcast at some point in time. The one other thing that I want to come back to, and as a means of potential critique for the Commission on International Religious Freedom here in the United States, is that the commission is granted a mission to look globally, to think globally about all these issues. And there's a lot of finger pointing at different countries. You mentioned Pakistan before and the Central African Republic saying, oh, you got to get your house in order. You got to get your house in order. But there's another country that should be included in all of this, and that's the United States itself. And some people, including myself, see that threats to religious liberty are on the rise here at home. And is there any consideration amongst the Commission on International Religious Freedom to look at our own country and to point the finger backwards and say, hey, maybe we have to get our house in order if we're talking about trying to improve the situation in other countries?
Well, Tony, our commission has no statutory authorization to examine domestic issues of religious freedom. And so when I'm wearing my hat as a member of the commission or when I was chairman of the commission, I'm very careful in that role not to address issues of religious freedom, although domestic issues of religious freedom, although I have said and will continue to say, even when wearing that hat, this much, which I think is fair, that the very best way that we can promote religious freedom abroad here in the United States is to honor it and respect it and protect it in the United States by setting an example to the world of a sound respect for religious freedom. So that much can be said. Now, taking off my commission hat and just speaking as an individual citizen, a scholar who's interested in human rights, and as a human rights activist, I can tell you that you're absolutely right. We have serious threats to religious freedom here in the United States. Now, they're not the kinds of threats, or not the level of seriousness that you find in China or North Korea or Vietnam or Pakistan or Egypt. However, at the same time, we shouldn't suppose that you only have religious freedom violations when you have circumstances that are as bad as you find them in those countries that I mentioned. We do have problems here. You have problems here in the area of protecting human life, where people of faith who do not want to participate in abortions based on their religiously informed moral convictions are nevertheless pressured or even forced to perform abortions or to assist in abortions or at least to refer for abortions against conscience. Now you're seeing similar things in the area of marriage and sexual morality, where people are being forced to treat same-sex partnerships as marriages or the equivalent when that is contrary to their religiously informed moral convictions on the matter. And those are just a couple of the many areas where we see threats to religious freedom arising. Part of it, I think, Tony, comes from this error in thought that we find common on the liberal side of the spectrum. It's not that all liberals make it, but it's a very common error among liberals. But that's the tendency to treat religion as a kind of hobby. You know, it's like stamp collecting or being interested in baseball or ballet. And sure, it's fine. People should be able to practice their hobby, but it's no big deal when you have to interrupt the hobby in order to advance some social or political goal. But religion is not just a hobby. Religion is something very central to the life and therefore to the dignity of the human person. And it can't simply be pushed aside and trampled on for the sake of achieving other social goals, even when they're desirable social goals. That's why we have the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in this country. It's to ensure, that's the act under which the Hobby Lobby decision was handed down by the Supreme Court. We have RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, in order to ensure that religion is not treated like a mere hobby, that it's given the centrality in people's lives that it deserves, that centrality is acknowledged by the law. And therefore, where a law substantially burdens the practice of religion, in order to pass muster under the statute, the government has the obligation of showing that the law is necessary to advance a compelling state interest and represents the least restrictive means of advancing that interest. That's the test that the Health and Human Services mandate under Obamacare, imposing on employers the obligation to provide contraceptives and even abortifacients. That's the standard, the test that the mandate failed. And that's why the Supreme Court rightly ruled as it did in the Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Woods cases.
Let me finish off with one last question as we are running out of time here. Actually, one last question and a favor, but the question here first. You've spent now 2 years on the international, or the Commission on International Religious Freedom. You've also know quite a bit about its operations over the past decade or so, decade and a half now, I guess. Are you fairly optimistic that it's making a difference out there, or is your experience that, well, maybe we should be a little bit more pessimistic about how difficult this task is?
Well, it's a very, very difficult task. I don't think we should be pessimistic, but I think we should be realistic. The situation for religious freedom is dire in many, many places in the world. And yet, the U.S. is extremely important. The United States has a lot of power. It's got a lot of influence. The United States can make a difference. You saw this, Tony, in the case of the freeing of Soviet Jews during the Reagan administration, where pressure from the United States, Senator Henry Jackson's activities in the Congress and the Reagan administration's activities, really did pressure the Soviet Union successfully into letting many, many of its Jewish citizens emigrate if they wished to get out of the country, in some cases to practice their faith, in other cases just to live lives in freedom. So U.S. policy can make a difference. And so we need to be doing on the Commission our part under the statute, playing our statutory role to prompt our country to use its power and influence in ways that will relieve the plight of many victims of religious persecution. We have seen some successes, not enough. We need many more. We've made only a small dent, but we have seen some successes coming out of U.S. foreign policy in this area. And so I'm just going to continue to work, as will my colleagues on the Commission, to have more and more and more successes. Now, we're not going to move that figure from 75% to 50% anytime soon. And even 50%, of course, would be way too high. But I'd like to see at least some progress, and I think we can make it. But that means that we're going to have to be gadflies, as I said. We're going to have to make tests of ourselves. We're going to have to speak out, even when it's unpopular, even when people would like to look the other way because trade interests or geostrategic and military concerns provide an incentive to downplay religious liberty issues. No, we have to speak out. We have to be bold. We have to be an irritant if necessary to keep the pressure on our government, to keep the pressure on foreign governments, to relieve the plight of the oppressed so that people can enjoy the natural human right they have. You asked about natural law. Here's a principle of natural law. Every human being has a natural human right to be able to pursue the truth about religious matters, and to live in line with his or her very best judgments as to what the truth is, so long as that person is willing to recognize and respect the rights of others and to practice his or her faith in a nonviolent, respectful way.
Well, amen to that, and you are the right person to do that because you have so many skills and talents, and this is where I come to the favor that I would like to ask for you, and I'd love to end up here on a light note. At the beginning of the interview, I noted that you were a banjo player. So before we go, would you be so kind as to give us an example of your banjo playing talent?
Well, why don't I give you an example with my whole band, playing the English folk tune Wedding Dress. I'm playing the banjo on this one in what's called the old-timer clawhammer style. I usually play in the bluegrass or scrug style, but this is an example of playing a different and I think quite wonderful style of banjo. So here's Wedding Dress. Thank you.
Okay, well, that was absolutely fantastic. And how convenient it was that your whole band was sitting in the room while you were doing the interview.
How about that? Can't beat that, can you?
Well, my guest today has been Robbie George. Robbie, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Very, very great pleasure to be on, Sonny. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.